You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over 40 years before WikiLeaks, the News of the World scandal, or Aaron Swartz, before cell phones or smartphones, there were freakers hacking Ma Bell, then the only phone company. An odd variety of teenagers and college students figured out the workings of what Phil Lapsley calls the world's largest machine, and at least two of them, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, went on to become enormously successful. Mr. Lapsley, himself a high-tech entrepreneur, gives an account of how these so-called freakers hacked into the phone system in his book, Exploding the Phone. It's published by Grubb Atlantic. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, most of us have heard of hacking, but I'd never heard of freaking until I saw this book. What's freaking, and why is it spelled with a PH instead of an F?
Freaking is hacking the telephone. So it is just as a computer hacker in the best possible sense of the word is interested in exploring and learning about and playing with a computer system, a phone freak is somebody who wants to do that same thing for the telephone. It was originally called Freak with an F. That's what they called themselves back in the late 1960s. And then at one point, a magazine article got written in Esquire that spelled it with a PH somewhat just for fun, and that really caught on.
Now, the 60s, that means this is before we entered the digital age.
That's right. This is back in the analog world. This is before personal computers, cell phones, internet, all that. This is when the highest tech thing in your house was probably your television set and your telephone.
And the person who first discovered how to do it, Joe Ingrizia, he wasn't even a teenager yet.
That's
let
right.
Alone a college student.
No, indeed. There were Joe Ingrizia and then actually a handful of people around that same time in the 1950s who just by listening to the telephone system, just by listening to the beeps and boops and clicks and clunks that it made, started to have these ideas about how the phone system worked. And then from that, they learned to make their own tones and to hack into the phone system and make it do things it wasn't intended to.
But Ingrizia was really young. So was it just chance that he found his way into the system?
I think it was chance coupled with obsession, perhaps. In the case of Joe Ingrizia, as young as 3 or 4 years old, he loved nothing more than listening to the phone and playing with it and dialing around with it and just using it in ways that people hadn't thought of. So I think it's one of these things where, you know, it may be chance, but the more time you spend doing something, the better chance you're going to have of it.
He had perfect pitch and he whistled the tones that he heard. And then discovered that they were taking him to places he didn't expect to go?
That's exactly right. And you know, the key thing about this phone freaking business is back in the 1960s, the whole telephone network was controlled by tones. They're kind of similar to the touch tones you use for dialing now. And there was a master tone, which was like 7th octave E, 2600 hertz. And if you could mimic those tones, you could actually control the telephone system. You could make your own calls. You could do all sorts of things.
So you could call long distance and control it. I remember people telling me there were ways that I could make long-distance calls free. It was because they had learned it through this freaking system?
That's exactly right. And it turned out you could, I mean, if you were Joe Ingrizia and you had perfect pitch and you were a gifted whistler, you could simply whistle using your lips, which is just incredible to me. If you were an electronics type guy, you could actually build little circuits that would make these tones. Or you could wait for the Quaker Oats Company to produce a Captain Crunch whistle as a free gift in cereal boxes, which just happened to make the 2600 hertz tone you needed.
Wasn't there a thing called a blue box?
There was. A blue box was the electronic device that made these tones. And so it cost about maybe $20 or $30. And with it, you know, it's a little thing, you know, much larger than an iPhone, but you know, it still fits in the palm of your hand and would allow you to make free phone calls, to route your calls anywhere in the world, and then to access various things, services and numbers that only the phone company was supposed to access.
Now, I'm assuming that when AT&T, and that was pretty much the monopoly here, although there were little independent phone companies in the 60s, but it was really AT&T, that when they came up with this system, they had no idea that anybody would be able to abuse it.
That's right. And when I've talked to the engineers from Bell Labs back in the day, I asked them, look, surely you guys must have realized that you had a vulnerability in your network. And the answer was universally, no, we had no idea. And, you know, you can forgive them for that, right? Because they were solving a really tough engineering problem. Nobody had built an automated network before. So you can forgive them for not thinking about the fact there might be hackers out there.
Well, how did the word go out? Today, of course, the internet is a good way for people to tell each other that you can do this sort of thing. But Ingresia was 4 years old, 5 years old. He wasn't about to get on the telephone and say, find other hackers.
No, that's right. The word went out by really kind of by happenstance and word of mouth. In particular, though, Ingresia played a key role when he was about 18 years old and he was a student at the University of South Florida. He was whistling free phone calls for his classmates, kind of as just on a bet. And he ended up getting in trouble, almost got kicked out of school, almost got arrested for it. But the resulting publicity generated some newspaper and radio and TV stories about it. And then all these other kids across the United States who had been doing this on their own and really independently, you know, their parents would hand them, you know, newspaper articles. Hey, there's this kid in Florida who can whistle free calls. And, you know, the first thing the kid says is, well, I better call that guy, right? And so you start to form this network.
Were there any women among these freakers?
Not that I've been able to find, no. It's entirely a young male activity, it seems.
And what was the ultimate appeal here? Just getting free calls? Or is it kind of like the way some kids obsess on things and just want another kind of a game.
It's really more the latter, I think, especially for the early phone freaks. As when I talk to these phone freaks, they would tell me over and over again, we were 15 and 16 years old. We didn't have anybody we wanted to call. What they were really interested in was, number one, figuring out how the telephone network worked. And number two, you know, kind of testing their wits to see like, wow, it seems like I can get something for nothing out of this. But it wasn't really to make lots of long-distance calls, although later that started to change. Other people started getting involved in the hobby, and their motivation was, in fact, making free phone calls.
And they gave themselves names, Captain Crunch, Joy Bubbles, several people with the last name Bernay.
Yes, that's right. This was because it was an illegal activity. Everybody adopted pseudonyms, and you'd have these sometimes very colorful pseudonyms like Captain Crunch. And that way, you know, if you got in trouble, you couldn't squeal out on your friends because you only knew them by pseudonyms.
Now, you describe the phone system as the world's largest machine, but weren't there individual companies in every country?
Well, there were individual companies in every country, but the thing which was interesting about the telephone system back then is it was the first time that all of these machines had been networked together, right? They all spoke these same tones, and they could all communicate with one another. And so even though you might have AT&T and General Electric and, you know, the United Kingdom's telephone service, they all had learned to communicate with one another and cooperate, which meant that if you could access one of them, you could probably access the rest of it.
How did freaking rise to something more serious than just simply joking around?
Well, for one thing, the phone company took it very seriously because they were afraid they were going to lose, you know, millions, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. So, you know, for them, for the phone company, it was no joke. It was their revenue at stake.
But we're not talking about millions of people. They probably were losing more like thousands of dollars.
That's absolutely right, except that the phone company's biggest fear was that this would spread. Right. And so their concern was not that, you know, half a dozen or a dozen or 100 college students are doing it. Their concern was that hundreds of thousands of Americans start doing it. Right?
And then I assume the level of prank kept on rising.
Yes, that's right. And so one of the things you have, you know, I think curiosity is a wonderful thing, but sometimes curiosity can lead you astray a little bit. And so one of the examples is at one point it turned out using a blue box, it was actually possible to wiretap other phone numbers. And for the most part, phone freaks just did this kind of as a lark, as a prank. One of the phone freaks, Captain Crunch, used his blue box to wiretap the San Francisco field office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which unsurprisingly took a dim view of it. And he ended up bragging about this to somebody who happened to be an informant for the FBI. So,
my guest is Phil Lapsley, Lapsley. He's written Exploding the Phone. It has a foreword by Steve Wozniak, who is one of your sources, I assume.
Yes.
And from what you write, it seems that the government repeatedly feared a Soviet attempt to compromise the phone system. So when they found out that this guy was tapping into the FBI's phone system, did they think that perhaps this was a serious national security matter?
Sure, that was their concern. I mean, if you know, some random hippie kind of a guy with a $30 tone generator can wiretap the FBI from, you know, across the country, they had to be worried that, you know, other people who were more motivated, maybe the Soviets, maybe the mob, would be able to do it too.
Well, many civil libertarians today are concerned about government surveillance of electronic communications. How far did the government or AT&T go in those days?
Well, AT&T had a real problem back in the 1960s, which was that it, as like we were talking about earlier, it simply didn't know how big this problem was. It didn't know if it was 1,000 people or 100,000. So they launched this program called Green Star, where they built machines that would monitor telephone calls at random. These are long-distance calls. And then when it found something that looked suspicious about the call, it would actually tape record the call. And over the 6 years that the program was running, from 1964 to 1970, they had monitored 33 million phone calls and actually tape recorded and listened to by ear 1.5 million of them, trying to detect evidence of fraud on their network.
And how many times did they find fraud? Were they prosecuting people?
They were not prosecuting people at the time, and the reason why was, number one, they were really concerned that they just simply first wanted to get an idea of how bad the problem was. And number two, what they found was that every time they prosecuted someone, the resulting newspaper articles would end up generating more phone freaks, right? So they had to be very selective about who they prosecuted.
Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, the founders of Apple, were into phone freaking. How did they compare to other phone freaks?
Well, so Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs learned about it from this Esquire article in 1972, and they became just incredibly enthralled by this idea that you could build this little device and control the telephone system.
The blue box.
The blue box, exactly. And they ended up actually selling them door-to-door in the dorms at Berkeley. You can guess which one of the two Steves might have come up with that idea. Steve Jobs later said that if it weren't for the blue box, Apple Computer never would have existed, because it was the first time that the two of them really had a chance to work together on a project.
And do something technological.
Exactly.
And they were never caught.
They were never caught.
They were really engaged in an illegal activity.
It's true. And they came very close to getting caught at one point. I write about in the book a little bit about a close escape, a close brush they had with the police. But no, they were never caught. And, you know, one wonders, you know, what would our society be like today if they had been caught and gone to jail? You know, we never had Apple Computer.
Well, were people being caught and being sent to jail?
Yeah, absolutely. By the 1970s, after the Esquire article came out, which sort of just laid open all the secrets of how this stuff worked, the phone company felt like it had no choice but to start prosecuting.
Well, you mentioned that Captain Crunch hacked into the FBI. Were they looking for specific targets, or was it just accidental that they would come upon something?
It would have been just accidental. And in the case of Captain Crunch, I really believe he was doing it really just for curiosity and probably bragging rights to say that he was able to do it. I don't think he had any particular plot against the FBI.
Well, we saw something similar with the internet, didn't we, where some kids were just hacking for the sake of hacking. Hey, I can get into the CIA's internet system, and so I'm going to see how far I can go.
Yeah, I think that is, you know, computer hacking and phone phreaking are very similar. It's really a question of what medium you're doing it in, right, whether it's a telephone or a computer. And I think that's where I think we run into a really interesting problem as a society. I think we want to encourage people to be curious. I think, you know, curiosity in teenagers and young people is a fantastic thing, and we want that. We want to nurture that. At the same time, curiosity can lead you down the wrong path, and you can end up doing things that you shouldn't do just because you were curious. And then once you're there, it's easy to cross the line and start doing criminal things. And so I think a challenge for us as a society is to figure out, how do we encourage curiosity on the one hand while preventing, let's say, kids from going off and doing something bad on the other.
Well, what impact do you think business and government crackdowns had on the people who were caught?
Well, I know for a number of them, it had a pretty significant impact on their life. You know, this Captain Crunch fellow, you know, in 1972, he was arrested and convicted and fined $1,000 for a 3-minute phone call to Australia that he made using his blue box.
And that's how they found him? They noticed there was a long-distance call that nobody was paying for?
Exactly. But the impact of that was that he now had a felony conviction. And if you think about it, a felony conviction is a serious thing. And so that changed his life, and not for the better after that.
Do other people admit to having done it, the ones who were not caught, other than Wozniak and Jobs?
Oh, yeah. Many of the phone freaks will not just admit to, but, you know, recall this as a time of joy and fun in their lives.
And have any of them become big successes? Obviously not as big as Wozniak and Jobs.
Every time I go to a reading of my book, invariably there will be some person who comes and has a nice chat with me. Maybe they brought a bunch of old electronic stuff from their basement. And at one of the readings in Menlo Park in California, the fellow at the end of our chat handed me his business card. And I won't say the name of the company, but he is the chief technology officer and founder of a very big consumer electronics company that we'd all know.
Well, I remember people offering me the opportunity to make long-distance calls using this blue box, and I didn't do it, partly because, maybe I was a little too straight-arrow. But also, I was afraid that you get caught when you do this sort of thing.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's exactly what AT&T wanted, of course, because they didn't want people making free phone calls, and so that was exactly the right reaction.
How did your own experience draw you into this subject?
So I was a geeky kid, and I got interested in this stuff when I was in junior high school, and I dabbled around with it, not nearly to the extent of anybody that I write about in the book. And then I got out of it and went on and did engineering and then later entrepreneurship. But it always seemed to me, kind of in the back of my mind, that there was this story of these phone hackers that was really interesting and had never been told before. And I was always kind of drawn back to that and wanted to write about it. And it started out really just as me scratching a 30-year-old itch of wanting to find out where did this stuff start and who were the first phone freaks and why did they like this stuff. And eventually it turned into a website and then it turned into a book.
But you're too young to have participated in much of this. Were you part of the early internet hacker generation?
I was part of the internet, the early personal computer and then internet hacker generation. And again, I use hacker in kind of the positive term of, you know, wanting to play with things and make them better. And so that was where I ended up focusing much of my effort.
And did you have a role in combating one of the earliest internet viruses or worms?
I did. Yes, that's right. Back in 1988, there was a thing called, which later became known as the Morris worm. It was really the first internet worm that happened. And I was involved in defending against that when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley.
We don't hear as much about worms and viruses today. Have we put up more effective firewalls, or just people not talking about them
anymore? No, people just don't talk about them anymore. They're incredibly commonplace. I mean, you know, if you put out a computer that is not protected on the internet, it becomes infected with worms very, very quickly.
Are teenage boys curious about hacking in the same way, or is everybody obsessed with launching the next Facebook these days?
Well, I think those two things kind of go hand in hand. I think that people who are curious about technology and want to learn about this stuff stand a very good chance of being the person who ends up launching the next Facebook. So, you know, I think I wouldn't frame it as an either or. I'd say it's both.
You write that the phone freaks taught us that there is a societal benefit to tolerating, perhaps even nurturing, the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers. How so?
Well, it's, I think, exactly what we were talking about earlier with the Steve Wozniaks and the Steve Jobs and various other people who've gone on to be successful, is that you want to take those people and take their curiosity and you want to harness it for the good of society, because those are the people who are going to end up, you know, founding the next Facebook or Apple Computer or just making a great success that none of us would have thought of.
Well, you wrote this book before Aaron Swartz committed suicide.
That's right.
Are you thinking about him when you're saying that kind of thing?
Yeah, I am. I mean, Aaron Swartz is a great example. Here's a kid who at 14 years old was making significant contributions to the way the internet worked with his authorship of various internet standards, went on to do all sorts of amazing things, and in the end, tragically took his own life after getting in trouble for what was portrayed as felony computer crimes. Now, I don't really know any of the details of the Aaron Swartz case, and that will be coming out, I imagine. But I cannot look at that as a good thing. I have to look at that as nothing but a great tragedy.
Now, not everyone agrees with you. The reviewer in the Wall Street Journal took issue with your assessment. He wrote that he sees the freaks as puerile and sinister precursors of today's malicious, pernicious cyber pranksters, and that sophomoric savants like them harm all too many innocent people.
I think if you were to look at the phone freaks that I write about in the earlier part of my book, you would find really absolutely nothing to complain about. These were people who didn't harm anybody. They were simply intent on exploring the network, you know, for the joy and curiosity of exploring and learning about the network.
And making long-distance calls without paying for them.
Many of them, yes, but not all of them. One of my favorite stories is a group of UK freaks who ended up getting arrested. And during the trial, it came out that of the 224 calls that they had made on one day, 222 of them went to non-working numbers, and the other two were actually legitimately paid for. So I don't think it's fair to paint all of them with the brush of wanting to make free phone calls.
And was this happening all over the world?
It was. It was happening at least in Europe at the same time it was happening in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So in particular in the United Kingdom.
Although I assume not in the places where we hear most of the hacking is taking place today, like China.
That's right. I don't know anything about China, India, Russia. Those were all kind of closed off at that period of time.
Well, when the reviewer says that these people are harm all too many innocent people, do you think he is thinking more of the hackers of today?
I do. And I think if you, again, if you go back to the early phone freaks, I think you'd be really hard-pressed to point at anyone they harmed other than, you know, perhaps AT&T and therefore its ratepayers by making a few free phone calls. But in fact, what I would see it as much more of a huge societal benefit from having taken curious people and encouraged them to go on to do interesting and societally beneficial things later in life.
Well, today we have situations where hackers go into the New York Times to find out who is sending an email to whom. So that's really quite a different scale, isn't it?
It definitely is, yes.
Now, you've also we mentioned that you came up with a way of fighting a worm. You have 19 patents?
Something like that, yes.
What do they cover mostly?
They're mostly covering fingerprint technology. I was working for a startup that I had co-founded that was to allow you to buy things at point of sale using just your fingerprint. And so patents were a large part of what we did in effort to protect the technology and then license it to other companies.
And those things always sound like a good idea, but I have not yet ever been asked to put my fingerprint on anything.
Indeed. And
except by the FBI when they arrested me. But that's another story.
It turns out there was a wealth of roadblocks between us and commercial success for that idea. So the idea...
Because of that very reason? It's the same reason that people object to their DNA being collected?
Oddly enough, no. It's funny. We did that startup company in Berkeley, and you can't imagine an audience that would be less sympathetic to putting their fingerprint down on a fingerprint scanner to buy a burrito than in Berkeley. And yet, people seemed to love it. They thought it was great. Really, the problems had to do with more entrenched interests at, you know, companies like Visa or MasterCard who wanted things to remain the same.
Phil Lapsley, Lapsley, his book Exploding the Phone, The Untold Story of the Teenagers and Outlaws Who Hacked Ma Bell. It is published by Grove Atlantic. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much for having me.